revering Buddhas and ancestors. We're one Buddha and one ancestor. In the middle of this concentrated session, gathering together to revere the Buddhas and ancestors through their stories. Our ancient family, our spiritual bloodline, these people we didn't meet in person, but we can meet today through their teachings. And revere them means honor their spirit of bodhicitta, their aspiration to knock out the wedges and strip off the blinders and be free for the benefit of all, each in their own unique way. So we're not revering their personalities, I don't think, although their personalities are unique and beautiful and each story is different. But their mind, their nature of mind as Buddhas and ancestors, revering that we are one Buddha and one ancestor, and awakening that Bodhi mind, we are one Bodhi mind. We and they are one mind of awakening, our one bodhicitta, our one aspiration to be free and express our life here and now. In an unhindered way. So for those arriving today, we've spoken of a few ancestors in our lineage in this book called The Transmission of Light by Keizan Zenji, our Japanese ancestor, who commented on these stories. We started with Qin Yuan, and then his disciple Shuto, who wrote The Merging of Difference and Unity. This is all around the 8th century in China. And Shuto's disciple is named Yao Shan Weiyan. Yao Shan means medicine mountain. Medicine Mountain, majestic consideration, Weiyan, and his posthumous name seems to be Hong Dao, expanding the way. And this story is one I feel very close to, appreciate very much, the story of Yao Shan's awakening. And I think it's coming just in time for this day of Sesshin, where we might, whether we've just arrived or if we've been sitting for a few days, we might be wondering what we're doing and how to actually practice this way. this kind of wondering. It's a very natural human thing. And the story, in fact, we could say all these ancestral stories are about wondering how to practice the way. And with, you know, wondering in deep sincerity, and then having the path clarified. So the 36th ancestor, great master Hung Dao, visited Shirto and asked him, by the way, Yaoshan in our, when we chant our lineage, is Yakusan Igen Daiyosho. And he's visiting Sekito Kisen, asking, I understand the 12-part teachings of the three vehicles for the most part. So this is just a Buddhist way of talking about the tradition of Buddhism, of Buddha Dharma. The 12-part teachings, you know, I couldn't tell you offhand what they are, but this is one of these early divisions. I think in the Pali tradition is like maybe an 8-part division, in the later Mahayana, or at least Sanskrit versions, there's this 12-part teaching, and they're basically, they're types of Buddha's teaching. So they're like sutras, for example, is the most common that we know of. And in fact, there seem to be like different kinds of sutras, but they're classified in these different ways. So like gathas is one of them, you know, like an unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect dharma is a gatha, or a verse. So Buddha sometimes taught in these verses. So there's sutras, gathas, udanas are like spontaneous expressions, and so on. Different types of early teachings of Buddha. So it's called the 12-part teachings. So it's the historical canon of Shakyamuni Buddha. And the three vehicles are the Shravaka, the listener vehicle, the Pratika Buddha vehicle, and Bodhisattva vehicle. Also, just classifications. And I think it's not explaining what they are, it's just saying all these classifications of Buddha Dharma, I understand them for the most part. Yaoshan saying, he was maybe kind of a scholar and studied the Buddha's teachings like this. I understand the 12-part teachings of the three vehicles of Buddha Dharma for the most part. I've studied all this, but I hear that in the south of China, right, they directly point to the human mind, see their natures, and become Buddhas. That phrase that's attributed to Bodhidharma, that was already well known, or somewhat well known at this time, because Yaoshan, I don't know if he was in the north exactly where he was, but he's talking about the south, meaning like Shaoqi, where the sixth ancestor lived, and this immediate school was forming, the tradition of immediacy based on Bodhidharma saying, a separate transmission outside the scriptures, outside the 12 divisions and the three vehicles, directly pointing to the human heart, seeing nature, becoming Buddha. Seeing nature, literally, kensho, seeing Buddha nature. Kensho Jo Butsu, seeing nature, becoming Buddha. So he's heard about this. And he maybe knows that Shirto is a Zen teacher in this separate transmission outside the 12-power teachings. Remember now, this is still like the beginning of Zen in China. Buddhism was widespread all over China, but it wasn't Zen. It was like more scholastic Buddhism, these 12 divisions of the sutras and so on. But I've heard about this movement in the south. They directly point to the human mind, see their nature, and become Buddha. This is still not clear to me. I humbly ask you in your compassion to explain it. And the master ancestor, Shirto, said, "This way won't do, and not this way won't do. And both this way and not this way won't do. How about you?"
Thanks a lot.
Now, just to mention here that this way is a translation of the Chinese term imo, meaning often translated as thus or such or suchness. And Dogen has a chapter called Shobogenzo Imo, in which he quotes this story. So we could also translate it as, so imo can mean like this, in this case, this way won't do. It can mean this, that. It can mean like this. It can mean such, thus, or suchness and thusness. And it's a colloquial term. It's not like a Buddhist technical term. Usually when they talk about suchness, which is actually a Buddhist technical term, ta-ta-ta in Sanskrit, referring to emptiness, it's actually a synonym of emptiness, but sometimes is also emphasizing the kind of positive expression of emptiness. The way suchness, and it's such a wonderful word in English, I think. Things such as they are, as it is. Suzuki Roshi said, "Things as it is." Maybe you've heard that, right? And somebody said, "Yeah, oh, in English actually, it's we say it, things as they are." And he said, "No, things as it is." So like this. Like this. Like this. And often when we hear suchness, we think, well, like this, just as it is, without adding anything extra to it. And in a way, we can say that, but what do we mean by this, just as it is? This, like this book. The suchness of this book is just this book. But, you know, again, technically or traditionally, suchness is actually talking about the emptiness of the book. The way the book really is that it's not a book. And yet, then there's also this expression of appearance of book is not separate from its lack of book. So very dynamic issue, suchness. And it has a very different feeling than just saying emptiness, right? Emptiness is really emphasizing the absence. Suchness is as it is, as it truly is. But as it truly is that it isn't. So we could also translate Shoto is saying this as being just so won't do, and being not just so won't do. Or being thus won't do, and not being thus won't do. And won't do is not, literally, again in Chinese now, is like not attaining toku, which is the same, this is a little divergence into Chinese terms here, but also Kathy asked about this term do toku, and quite straight, which means, we were talking about yesterday, means expression, like complete expression. And the word do, the character do, is the same as Tao, and we say in Chinese the Tao, the way, but it's a completely, like in English, words have more than one meaning. So in this case, it actually doesn't mean the way or the path, it means speech. Now, why they chose this word that most commonly does mean the way or the path in both Buddhist usage and colloquial usage. You know, they use for, like on street signs, they use Tao as the, like a way or path, a street, but it also means speech. So it's hard when you're reading these things, especially in Zen texts where they use the character Tao a lot, you have to, I think translators really have to know how it's being used there in context, whether they're talking about speech or the way, which is completely different. Anyway, do, toku, when these are combined, do means speech, and toku can mean like attain. Toku do, we say in both lay and priest ordination, are called toku do. And somewhere early on in San Francisco Zen Center, somebody said, oh, do means way, right? But, you know, these the sounds, there's many, many different meanings. So it's not the same character. It doesn't mean to attain. We don't say leaving home to attain the way or staying home to attain the way. That character do, in this case, is the do of Remi. No, it's the do of paramita. Shujo muhen seigan do means beings are numberless. I vow to paramita them. I vow to save them. It actually means, so again, it's not just a Buddhist term. It means like to cross over or to save or to liberate, we maybe could say. So this is a completely aside now, but actually, like shuke tokudo means leaving home to attain salvation or liberation, literally. Zaike tokudo means staying home to attain crossing over. So do toku, you know, you could read it as like the way attained, but actually that's not the meaning. It's like, toku can also mean like complete, which is related to attain or like to touch something, to actually reach something, is closely related to complete something. So, do toku could be like complete speech or complete expression. So that's a little etymology of this term that Dogen is very fond of, do toku. Has a whole chapter called Shobogenzo Do Toku, complete expression. So in this case, being emo does not toku. So being just so, being such, does not attain it. We could translate it as does not attain it or does not complete it. Is not being such is not complete. Here it's translated as won't do. Being thus won't do. Now, but to bring out this attain part, Chinese is quite dynamic here. So Andy Ferguson, who is a wonderful translator, some of us know, he comes here sometimes, He translates this as, you can't attain it this way. Instead of being so, well, won't do, or this way won't do, and not this way won't do, he says, you can't attain it this way, and you can't attain it not this way. We could say, this being such doesn't complete it, not being such doesn't complete it. That is a, so, Kaz Tanahashi, our other kind of in-house translator. Throws another twist in there. He says, he translated it as, thusness is ungraspable. Beyond thusness is ungraspable. Both thusness and beyond thusness are ungraspable. How about you? Chung Chien Bhikshu translates as, thus will not do, not thus will not do, either thus or not thus, none will do. So, this might sound like a strange way of talking, but I think this is often how we feel in Zazen. This might be our experience several days into Sesshin, like, this isn't working, whether it's about like attaining some stability or presence, this won't do, this way won't work, that way won't work, you know, doing the opposite of that won't work, like just to concentrate my mind really, really strongly, for example, focus, every breath, do not veer off. No, this is getting really uptight. I'm just not relaxed at all. This won't do. Okay, so just relax. Just relax. Oh, yeah. Lunch is coming soon. I wonder what Johnny will cook us up today. So, not that uptight way. That won't do either. And to kind of mix them together in some way, both this way and that way, won't do at all.
What's your demo with that?
Let's be really concentrated on the thought of what is lunch. Instead of just letting the mind wander there, okay, what is lunch?
Okay.
A little bit like what Koji was bringing up yesterday, like if can we focus on a thought as like a meditation object? We might try to do that, mixing them together. I don't know if that would really be it, but... And for those who've studied Nagarjuna here, he often speaks in this way, you know. But we talked about the tetralemma. This is actually a trilemma. He skipped one of the lemmas. A tetralemma is a four-part dilemma. A dilemma is like a two-part problem. I guess a trilemma would be three-part, like this. So like, this won't do, not this won't do, both this and not this won't do, and then the tetralemma is usually, neither this nor not this won't do. And it's quite a bit like this. This is kind of like Madhyamaka dialectics, because it's talking about being and non-being, actually. So quite literally, Nagarjuna will say things like, existence is one extreme that won't do. That's an extreme view. But non-existence is another extreme view. And they try to combine them into some like mushy, like it kind of exists, but kind of doesn't exist. No, this is just, it won't work. And then even to go so far as, well, neither non-existence nor existence in some, as a kind of held view, that also is off. Nothing that we can come up with our conceptual mind, actually, will do. Suchness actually won't do, but not suchness won't do either. and both such and not such won't do at all. How about you? Yao Shan was speechless. How could he be otherwise? And Shoto said, your conditions for understanding are not here, or your affinity for this Dharma is not here, at least right now. It doesn't seem like you don't get it. So go see great master Ma Matsu, who was another one of, maybe some might say, the greatest Zen master of all time, Matsu. He had like 80 awakened disciples and hundreds and thousands of people practicing with him, and spread the Dharma everywhere. We on this trip with Andy Ferguson to China to visit these places, we went to Matsu's temple, and which is not that big a place right now, and it's right in the middle of a city. But they told us that in Matsu's time, it like kind of was the city, this monastery. The story is that the gates that they close at night around the wall of the monastery, they had to ride a horse to close all the gates because it was so huge. So Matsu, with many amazing stories about Matsu, and maybe we'll tell some, because the story involves Shoto and Matsu, and they seem to be friends. There's, I didn't find any conversations of them actually talking together, but they seem to know each other and send students back and forth to each other.
I think Matsu came down off of one of the earlier branches.
Yeah, so we have... That's right, Nanyue. So we have Wei Nung, the sixth ancestor, the root of all Zen lineages, and then he had many students, but the main ones were Nanyue and Qingyuan. So we heard about Qingyuan, who it continued from Qingyuan to Shirto to Yaoshan, and the other line continued Nanyue to Matsu, to Baijiang, Huangbo, and Linji. Yeah, so many great Linji ancestors. In fact, all we call the five houses of Zen in China, of which the so-called Soto and Rinzai lines have continued up to present day in modern America, which we're the Soto holders here. And the other three just died out because this happens if it's not kept alive. Yes?
Just a technicality. So actually, Matsu and Shirto.
Mm-hmm. Or Shirto.
Shirto. Second toe.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyhow, they were friends, and this was pre-Soto Rinzai.
Yeah.
Anyway,
but Rinzai wasn't born yet. Yeah. Yeah. And neither was Dongshan. So yeah, pre.
There was maybe some sensibility of it. But
yep.
It hadn't been kind of like, okay, now.
Yeah, it wasn't like a split.
Yeah.
And in fact, yeah. And even this thing about the five schools and the split that later became more like a solid split, as I understand it, wasn't until much later, maybe even like the Song Dynasty, when like the five houses didn't call themselves the five houses. It was just all these branching streams. But then later people looked back and said, oh, look at these interesting styles. And, I think we're starting to see this in America. There, within Soto Zen, there's these different styles branching out. Sometimes that maybe we'll have like the five houses of American Zen, or 380 houses.
Yes.
Thousand houses, right? Yeah. So this is something about. Something has to be. I mean, this is a whole big topic that would be a sidetrack, I think. But but like, how, you know, what makes a style and what continue, because there does seem to be something, maybe it's not so clear with Shuto and Matsu here, that these flavors, but by the time of Linji and Dumshan, there were definitely distinct flavors of these styles of teaching. And I think they continued into the Sung dynasty. We have like Da Wei on the Linji side, and at the same time as Hung Jur, the silent illumination teacher. And so they were, by that time it was like there really are these distinct styles. And in modern Japan and America, still. So this is just starting to divide at this point. So Shuto sends Yaoshang to Matsu. And so Yaoshang goes to Matsu, pays his respects, and asks the same question. In other words, I understand the 12-part teaching and the three vehicles, but I hear in the south they point directly to the human mind, see nature, and become Buddha. I humbly ask you in your compassion to explain it. And Matsu says, sometimes I make him raise his eyebrows and blink. Sometimes I do not make him raise his eyebrows and blink. Sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking is all right. Sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking is not all right. How about you? With these words, Yaoshan was greatly awakened.
And the eyebrow did it.
And he bowed. And the ancestor Matsu said, well, what truth, what principle of the way have you seen that makes you bow? Like, something happened to you there. What did you see? Tell me about it. And Yaoshan said, when I was with Shuto, I was like a mosquito trying to bite an iron bull.
Remember that.
Yes. Yeah, I want to discuss this a little bit more later, this line too. This is a line that's traditionally recited in the Shuso ceremony, coming from the story. But there's a nice commentary on this very line later by Keizan that gives a different twist. For me, it was a surprising twist on this line. Well, when I was with Shuto, I was like a mosquito. Here it says, mounting an iron ox. Sometimes we say biting or, you know, but what an amazing image, right? This giant, I mean, an ox already is so tough. You know, how can a mosquito even get to an ox hide? But an iron ox, and this mosquito, like, is it called a proboscis?
Proboscis.
Proboscis? Trying to get that proboscis into that iron ox hide. Like, well, you get the image. And Matsu says, so, you know, what do you see that you bow? Well, when I was with Shuto, it was like a mosquito trying to bite an iron ox. And Matsu said, since you are so, you must guard it well, but still your teacher is Shuto. Mm-hmm. So that's the end of the story. So all kinds of interesting things going on here about he had some problem with Shuto. He couldn't find a way in. Shuto sent him to Matsu. Matsu said almost the same thing, right? Slightly different way. And he got it and said, oh, you got it, but actually your teacher is Shuto. Even though Shuto said, you don't have affinity here. He's saying, your affinity is back there. So a little bit about the second part now, to just get into the raising the eyebrows and blinking.
Was it for me?
Now there's again, Chinese, I don't really know Chinese so much, but like it seems like these skilled translators are translating this in quite different ways that are very different feelings. So this one is, sometimes I make him, and him is capital H, like which is one of these words that I think in the introduction here, that Keizan uses these terms like for, I think we could say Buddha nature, like the lord of the house, things like this. And him, I think, is one of these words that Keizan uses, or like the one about holding up the whisk. Does this or it exist at Saochi? This, these, you know, short phrases that are just Zen ways to talk about the untalkable. So, you know, or, you know, maybe him could refer to Yaoshan standing in front of him. Sometimes I make him. But it, the fact that it's capitalized here is quite interesting, I think, because it's like, I don't say sometimes I make you raise your eyebrows and blink, but I make him, like, your Buddha nature, you'd say. And who knows whether when Yaoshan arrived and said, please, in your compassion, Master, explain it to me. And like he was kind of in awe. Matsu apparently was like 8 feet tall and like had this giant, you know, like protuberance on his head and was a very like imposing character. So little Yasha might be like, please explain it to me. And he's like, sometimes I make him raise his eyebrows and blink. But him... now, again, so here's Andy Ferguson, who I think all these were translated already, so I think he tried to offer creative alternatives. So he translates it, sometimes I teach it by raising my eyebrows and blinking. Sometimes I teach it by raising my eyebrows and blinking. Sometimes I do not teach it by raising my eyebrows and blinking. Sometimes teaching it by raising the eyebrows and blinking is right. Sometimes it's not right. And also, this all right is also toku. So sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking attains it, or you know, completes it, reaches it. Sometimes it doesn't. Or let's see. So yeah, in here we have yes.
Okay. Well, what did Shuto say?
Shuto said first he said being this way won't do, and not being this way won't do. Being both this way and not this way won't do either. How about you? Mm-hmm. And Matsu says raising. Sometimes I make him raise his eyebrows and blink. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes raising eyebrows and blinking is right, sometimes it's not right. How about you? So, and whether or not Yaoshan told Matsu what Shirto had said or not, or whether they both just always spoke this way, in this, they both kind of spoke in this kind of like tetralemma kind of way, we don't know.
The difference I noticed between the two is, mm-hmm. like Matsu's way is kind of more like you have some skill and control over this or something, mm-hmm. rather than like it seems like Shirto's way is kind of like, well, you know, stuff happens and you can't help it or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Matsu's way is kind of like, you know, like there is a way to. Kind of like that verse in the commentary to the "Why do you put on your case at the sound of the bell?" It says something like writing sound and form or something like that. But kind of like this is something that one can be mastered, and all of the all the dharmas can be employed, like, skillfully, or something like that. I don't know.
How is that with raising the eyebrows and blinking? Is something that he could do?
Yeah, like, sometimes I have him, or something like that. You know, rather than to do this is no good, to do this is no good. Mm. You know, like, sometimes I have him do this. Mm. It's kind of like a little bit more of a broader...
Well, it's, for one thing, it's not saying that nothing will do, right? The first shukta is just saying, this won't do, some combination won't do, period. And Matsu is saying, sometimes this happens, sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes it's right. Sometimes it's all right, or sometimes it attains it. We could translate it. Sometimes it reaches it. It hits the mark. Sometimes it doesn't. But it's a little more, like, there's a little more opening there. Is that kind of...
Yeah, I think so. I couldn't pin it down, but I have some kind of feeling. Mm.
And it gives him some person... It's also more personal. You could say the first is more like a philosophical statement about this and not this. And the next is about their interaction, their very personal interaction. Meeting and eyebrows raising and blinking. Now, another dynamic thing here, so Dogen brings this story up in, looks like, these two fascicles. One's called Emo, right? A fascicle called Such. He brings up this story and briefly comments. And he brings up the story, and he actually only tells the part about Shurto's part of the story in the Emo fascicle, because that's the one where Such is right, Such is not right. Matsu doesn't use Emo, right? Matsu just talks about the raising the eyebrows and blinking. But Dogen also quotes Matsu's part in another fascicle called Uji, which is the topic for our study in class this fall, next week. Shobogenzo Uji means the time being. So actually what this says here in the original story is, where it says, sometimes I make him raise his eyebrows and blink. Uji, I make him raise his eyebrows and blink. Or for the time being, I make him raise his eyebrows and blink. For the time being, I don't make him raise his eyebrows and blink. For the time being, raising eyebrows and blinking is right, and for the time being, it's not right. I think that's how cause. So Kaz translates this as, Matsu says, for the time being, have him raise his eyebrows and blink. For the time being, do not have him raise his eyebrows and blink. For the time being, to have him raise his eyebrows and blink is right. For the time being, to have him raise his eyebrows and blink is not right. It's all about upaya, skillful means.
It's like a little demonstration, I think, of upaya. Mm-hmm. It isn't any one thing.
It's
what's the time being?
Yep.
What's the...
The occasion.
The occasion, the need, response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, you could say that with every one of these stories is like a skillful means. What they're opening to in every case is exactly the same. There's no two natures of mind, and yet the stories are so different. Often they're quite similar, but there's such variety, and that's exactly it. Yeah, it's all a matter of skillful means. We could even say Zen is a skillful means tradition and has very unusual skillful means. That doesn't, you know, the 12 divisions of the canon are also skillful means. But this is a completely different thing going on here. Yes?
I just found this, the eyebrows in it. Yes. Isn't it an intimate meeting with the master called Tangling Eyebrows?
Yeah, we do have that image, various images, metaphors with the eyebrows in Zen. Yeah, like eyebrows entangled, like, you know, seeing eye to eye so close that eyebrows get all tangled up together. Mm-hmm. And we also have the same, maybe unrelated image of if we speak or explain too much, our eyebrows fall out. Like where there's some case about, like, you know, all practice period I've been speaking to you all so much and I'm afraid that I've lost my eyebrows. And, you know, maybe it's related in the sense that to really meet eye to eye, it has to be in this realm that can't be explained. So if we explain too much, we have no eyebrows to be entangled. Yeah.
So I just want to verify that I understand something.
It won't do.
Okay, so there's this dialogue, this won't do, that won't do, and that won't do either.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that kind of symbolizes some kind of detachment from the outcome. And is that a correct feeling for it? Like, this idea of just non-gaining,
yep,
detachment.
Just, yeah, I think...
This won't do, that won't do, suchness.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be the direction here, especially if we take it as that toku, to mean attain, being like trying to get it this way doesn't attain it. You can't attain it like this. You can't attain it not like this or like that, and you can't attain it like this or that. So yeah, without trying to attain it in these various ways, it's completed. So I think there is that issue. And yeah, it's pointing towards that direction of trying to get something in some way. That's why I say that often we get to this point in Sesshin and that frustration can arise because things might not seem to be working right. So there's some, we might start to, I think this is an encouragement that, is there something that's like completely like not our, even right, all our strategies of how to practice Sesshin or practice anything start to like fall away because it's like, well, and also I think we start to see we get more and more intimate with our mind. We start to see, I'm just, everything's contrivance. Everything I do is just like me like contriving something. It's not just like, how could this be the natural Buddha mind? And so there can be a surrender to not trying to get it, but not a surrender into, oh, well, just I give up, I'll just like hang out and bide my time, because that won't do it either. What is the surrender that doesn't fall into any extremes of either gaining or just avoiding the issue or like, giving up in a more apathetic kind of way, so that surrender into what is quite tricky. I also feel a personal connection with this story because I remembered as I started looking at it this time when I was living in Tassajara and I was trying to practice very diligently And I felt like I was like confused but on the right track. And I had just been ordained as a priest, and I was like, now I am totally, this is it. I left home, and now I'm just like, just stay here at Tassajara now, maybe forever, and immerse body and mind in the way, like, nothing can stop me now. I am like, my direction is totally clear. And then, I think that's what happens sometimes. Like, this way will do. This way will attain it. And so then I met this woman during, like, actually the day before my ordination. How do these things happen like that? Because I was living in Tassajara and she was at Green Gulch where my ordination was, and I just met her and thought, oh, what an interesting person. And we met and talked, and then she came down to Tassajara that practice period where I went back, and we just started getting really close, and pretty soon I was questioning what was going on here. And at that time, you know, since my time, my teacher has asked people who are ordained, well, if you're not in a relationship when you get ordained, please don't get in one for the next 5 years. Yeah, this, like, if you're already in one, then it's okay. So it's not about that it's a better thing or something. It's just the issue of establishing a new relationship takes a lot of time and energy. That's definitely my experience. It's like, that's where your energy is totally going. And I think he wanted to honor that. This would, you know, for some people might not understand and feel like that's just being too old-fashioned or something. But in my own experience, I kind of understood where he's coming from, because it's like, you know, you should take, you know, if you want to do this relationship thing, take care of it completely. Give it the time and energy it needs, which you don't have in the monastery. In practice period, there's no time to do that. You'll be divided, actually. So just do that. So he was, I think, a little disappointed, because it takes a lot to ordain someone, and he said, so please, you know, leave. If you want to do this, go away, and not go away forever, but go away, take care of this, establish this relationship. While you're gone, don't wear your robes, you just got ordained, so you won't be in training with me if you leave, so just, you're still a priest, it can't ever be reversed. But don't show yourself as such in the world if you're not in training with me. So, and that was a very difficult decision to make, as you can imagine. Very difficult, because I wanted to be ordained for so long. And I hadn't been interested in relationships for years and years before this. Single-minded, one way. This is how these things work.
I can offer you a little teaching on this from my teacher.
Yes.
You never, one of her least favorite things about life is that you never get anything until you don't want it anymore.
Yeah, I think it often does work that way. That's good. Tenshin Roshi also would say, when people were wondering, should I leave? I'm not sure if I should leave Tassajara, for example, if they're there for some years. I'm having a hard time and I think I should go. He'd say, like, wait till you don't care whether you go or not, and then go. If you really want to go, don't go. So we have things like this. So then what happened? So I left. It was very difficult, but I felt like this is the direction of the unknown. It's like I had some inkling that, like, you know, this way might be limited. Maybe I was too fixed on this way. So, like, let's see what this offers. I kind of know what this offers too. I kind of know where it's going. If I do this, my trajectory will be clear for many years. This way is completely unknown. In fact, terrifying. But let's do it. That's the spirit of that I wanted to actually leave home. That was my feeling about leaving home. Even though this looked like giving up the leaving home, it was like diving into the unknown, where it's like, what's going to happen? Where are we even going to go? It's like, my home is, for many years, is Tassajara. I have nowhere else to go. So we did that, and then we just were traveling around for a long time, and eventually landed somewhere in Arizona, and I was there, and after half a year, you know, we didn't really know each other either. I mean, we were kind of thrown, we just had met, and it's like, well, you shouldn't do this here at the monastery, so just go do it out there. Good luck, kid. where? I was clueless. And, you know, so we're just thrown into this thing. The whole, our task was like, do a relationship. Establish your relationship. Hi, what's your name again? It wasn't quite that extreme, but it was strange, though. It was not a normal situation. So we did that, and of course, as we got to know each other, it got difficult, because that's how things work. And it got more and more difficult. And I was like, what have I done? This track I was totally on. I was so inspired and clear about my life. And now I'm like totally confused. And I'm actually like, I'm doubting everything. This, like, I left everything for this relationship. And now this relationship is like, well, what's this about? Do I really want to do this? But I can't just get out of it. My assignment, my teacher's assignment, is to establish it. So I was writing to him at this time, and from Arizona, writing him all these letters about how totally crazy I was. And he's the type who actually never really writes back. I don't think I had a phone or anything either. But miraculously, one day I got this letter. I've gotten a few letters from him. In Japan, when I was in Japan, he wrote me some letters too. And when I read the story, I thought of this letter because it mentions the story, and I found it. An old letter. Dear Charlie. On Tassajara Stationery. I mean, this is kind of personal, so I hope it's okay for like the internet and everything.
I'll take it to you.
You know, he thanks me for staying in touch by letter and phone calls and so on. And he quotes, you know, that allows him to see my, quote, deluded neurotic chatter, which I guess was in one of my letters. He's quoting me. Like, all my life, my whole life is just diluted neurotic chatter. Thank you very much for showing this to me through your words. He says, I think you're a lot like our great ancestor Yao Shan when he was young. as you know, he was very sincere and observed the precepts scrupulously. It says that in the commentary. He was really into precepts. And so before I ran off with some woman, I was really into I was really into precepts, the whole Vinaya thing, and really wanted to practice this very traditional monastic way. And then he quotes this whole story, basically, of the Denko Roku, and says, one day, Yaoshan said to himself, a true person of the way ought to purify himself apart from the rules and laws. Who would believe that it's simply a matter of being scrupulous about trifling actions? This is in this later commentary here. So he went to Sherpa's place and said, I understand the 12-part teachings of the three vehicles for the most part, but I hear them in the south, etc. It's still not clear to me. I humbly ask you to explain it. Sherpa said, being this way won't do, and not being this way won't do either. Being this way and not this way won't do at all. How about you? And then his commentary is, is your mind in unity? I think this was a thing like, but there's that practice over there that I really want to be doing, and there's this practice over here that is like, seems to be a big mistake, and like, isn't that way better? Or should I be doing this way? It was like, I was divided. I was split. And it was, an uncomfortable situation, as you know, when the mind is divided. So, I don't remember what my letters actually said, but he brings up this issue. Is your mind in unity? Unity is the most important thing. So, when we'll get involved in this way, not this way, will this do, that do, raising eyebrows, not raising eyebrows. Is your mind in unity? Unity is the most important thing. If you can just sit without sleeping, this was, I think, an issue at the time, and for many years, whole practice periods at Tassajara. It's true, we don't get much sleep there, but I don't think that was so much the issue. Other people weren't constantly falling asleep, but I was just always sleeping in Zazen. I really worked with this for years and years. And occasionally still do, but somehow it's like, it's not so much like an issue somehow. I think it wasn't about lack of sleep. It was like a block. And I think it was something about like, this way, like I got it clear, right? This way, but then there's this like back of the mind, like, really? Will this way do? And like, again, like the divided mind, like, because the divided mind is very uncomfortable, one of the great cures for being uncomfortable is to go to sleep. And again, it's not that comfortable to sleep while sitting cross-legged, but hey, you gotta sit. In the Zendo, might as well sleep. I didn't want to sleep, but I couldn't help it.
I heard Darlene say that the second best comfortable sleep was in the Zendo. The first was in bed, but if you've got to be up, it'll do.
Yeah, I mean, there's something that's still like, because it's obviously not that sound asleep in the Zendo. So I think there's a way in which we can. It's actually a kind of like, it's a really challenging way to practice, because it's like you can't really settle and you can't really wake up either. But sometimes we can take a little nap while we're sitting, and it's somewhat restful. Maybe. Unity is the most important thing. If you can just sit without sleeping and realize this oneness, everything will become simple. Until then, one is lost in confusion. So it's up to you, my dear. With wholehearted love and respect. Unity is the mind. If the mind is in unity, everything is clear. And otherwise, we're lost in confusion. Whether it's like totally lost in confusion, or even just like a little bit more like this, or a little bit more not like this, a little bit more like that, or couldn't it be a little more like over there, or what about shifting it a little this way, and what about oh yes, like this, oh no, not quite like that. So unity is just like no division. The master's name was Wei Yan. Yao Shan's name was Wei Yan. Also, Hong Dao. He was the son of the Han family in Jingzhou. He left home when he was 16 under Zen teacher Wei Zhao in the western mountains in Luoyang. He received the precepts from precepts master Xi Zhao of Mount Hong. He was widely acquainted with the sutras and treatises and observed the precepts scrupulously. One day he lamented to himself, "A true person ought to purify himself apart from the laws and rules. Who would believe that it's simply a matter of being scrupulous about trifling actions?" I mean, there is. We do emphasize being scrupulous about trifling actions, but it's not just a matter of that. In fact, in the early canon, that actually emphasizes the early Buddhist teachings, right? Emphasizes a lot of scrupulous actions. Interestingly, the fetters or bindings that drop away, according on the Buddha's, one of the Buddha's many lists, right, that drop away at the moment of what's called stream entry, at the moment of seeing nature clearly and directly, because then there's these later stages, right, leading up to Arhat in that tradition, and each stage is defined by what's dropped away. Buddhism is always about like not getting some things, it's more like removing things, letting go of things. So various more and more subtle obscurations, we could say, are dropped away along the path. So for this first stage of seeing Buddha entering the stream of Dharma fully, what's dropped away is the view of the independent self, that's one. Clearly and directly seeing through this illusion that there's somebody behind or in addition to these five aggregates. Doubt about that, really, but also about the practice and the path, like, because then one sees that everything else is in a different context, and like, oh, the whole practice is now in this context of there's not me doing it, it's just happening. So all kinds of doubts about what I should be doing to practice would cease. And then the third one of the three is grasping like rules and precepts and like rituals as the path to freedom and liberation. Shila Vrata Paramarsha. So Shila is really like ethical precepts, right? And Vrata is like, often translated as like rituals, and kind of grasping them, or sometimes translated like fondling them. I kind of like, just kind of like getting too overly involved in these things. And but this is in a tradition where it's like totally permeated with precepts and ceremonies, right? So, but it's just saying, so you don't stop doing them. It just says that those aren't the path. And it just to just be scrupulous about trifling actions will not free you from suffering. And this is, that belief is dropped away at that moment of seeing Buddha, because then you see it's not a matter of these things. Yet, those things are still important, and Buddha has practiced them. So it's just a different context. Yes?
I mean, you just made me think again about Colvin's approach to ceremonies and rituals. And he certainly, you know, well, I shouldn't say that, I'm not his mind, but he was very unique in his approach, and he did them beautifully.
Mm.
That's that cavorting nature. You know, it's just this total dance, and yet he treated them all very lightly, even though, you know, he did ordinations, he did all the ceremonies. They were just unique and beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, not holding to some necessarily fixed way. But again, in this case, as far as this obscuration or fetter, it's like, I think it's particularly around the belief that doing things, even doing things in a cavorting way or a traditional way, is the cause of the liberation. So that might be the effect of that. But also I think one could just, like, we're just going to follow by the book exactly, and we're really, like, let's really do it, and it's a real problem if we don't. But this is not, like, the main issue here. This is not that. There's a training in that, we could say. This would be another approach that we're training our just, like, attention and letting go through this way, but doing them in a certain way is not the issue of liberation. Still, it might be, in either case, it could be like, that's our ground or our format for liberation could happen there, when we see that it's not we're totally immersed in it, but it's not about that. And so maybe that's what his thing is, like, he was totally immersed, Colvin, and but it was clear that it wasn't about a particular way. So he kind of had this intuition, it looks like. Shuddha said, a true person ought to purify himself apart from the laws. Who would believe that it's simply a matter of being scrupulous about trifling actions? Right away, he went to Shuddha's room and asked, I understand the 12-part teachings, and so on. And then that story all happened. Then he was stayed at Matsu's, even though Matsu said, still your teacher, Shuddha. Then he stayed and was Matsu's attendant for 3 years. That's kind of like curious too. One day, Matsu said, how do you see things these days? Yaoshan said, I have shed my skin totally, and there is only the one reality. Matsu said, what you have acquired is said to agree with the essence of mind and pervades all your activities. This being so, you should gird your loins with 3 strips of bamboo sheathing and go live on a mountain somewhere and teach. I have no idea.
Underpromise.
I actually had to look up 2 different translators say gird your loins. I had to look that up in the dictionary, and gird means to like put something around, and it means like to get ready for battle or something, right? Like get ready for a struggle here, like kind of muster your energy for a big task. Yeah, is that right? But three strips of bamboo sheathing. I mean, that's what it says, right? I think this this one says something like, since that's so, you can tie three strips of bamboo around your stomach and become the head of a community. Makes it more clear. Yeah, maybe something like brace yourself. And maybe this was some old Chinese expression, right? They really did. Oh, okay. I bet that's it. Because why would you use bamboo? Wouldn't be comfortable clothing, but bamboo armor, yeah. So it's maybe like a metaphor of like, now you're gonna, which was often the case here, like you've realized a lot, now you gotta go deep in it, really refine it, and muster up all your energy to really, really get to work. Yeah. I think this is often the spirit of like, you know, you're practicing a lot, like, now I really feel like I got something, now really get to work. And there's a lot of differences in this next part here. I'll just finish this story. So this one says, how could I dare say I will go live on a mountain and teach? Or how can I presume to live on a mountain? You know, and teach is in parentheses because I think the interpretation is when you open a mountain, it's like opening a temple to teach. So Matsu says, so you should go live on a mountain somewhere and teach. Well, how could I dare presume to go live on a mountain and teach? Matsu says, if otherwise, you will always, you know, if you don't, kind of like this, if otherwise, you will always be going when you're staying and staying when you're going. Even if you want to benefit others, you will have no one to benefit. Even if you want to carry out practice, there will be nothing to practice. You should make a boat to ferry others across and not stay here very long. So Yao Shan left Matsu and returned to Shirto after 3 years or so. So that's a strange little dialogue. Chung Qian Bikshu says, translates it, says, instead of this part about you will always be going when you're staying and staying when you're going, he says, there has been no one who has always practiced without starting to teach. There is no one who has taught without having practiced. And part of what's happening here is that it's this character, Gyo, that, like in Gyoji, that means, practice. Shugyo is another name for practice. Gyo means actually to do, to act, but a spiritual practice. And it also means to walk. It's the character that's actually in Kinhin, pronounced differently. Hin, it's the Hin character. So it means to practice or to walk. So again, so we have this Chinese thing, and then the other part is like the other character in question is abide, reside or abide, and it's the one that's used for like it's a sort of Jew character. I think this is the same. It's like an abbot of a temple is called Juji, means like residing and abiding. The abiding teacher is the one who resides or abides in that place. And so when he's saying go to the mountain and abide there, some interpretations are go to the mountain and, you know, be like the abiding teacher. So this translation says there has been no one who has practiced without starting to teach. There is no one who has taught without having practiced. And then, So Andy Ferguson, completely different take here, he uses this practice character as going, walking, which is also used in like pilgrimage. Angya is a Zen term for pilgrimage. It means like... Usually it's pronounced gyo, gyo. Like you can find it in like gyoji, which we translate as continuous practice. But it's also used for like pilgrimage, which is walking. So Andy says, those who haven't gone on a long pilgrimage can't reside as abbot. So, your choice. We can talk about this other story this afternoon, but since there's another period of zazen, I'll just recite shortly this story because you can take it as a zazen instruction. One day while he was doing zazen, you might have heard this, Shirto asked him, Yaoshan, what are you doing here? Yaoshan said, I'm not doing anything at all. He was done like trying to do this way or that way. I'm done with that. I'm not doing anything at all. So Shirto said, in that case, you're sitting idly. Yaoshan said, if I was sitting idly, that would be doing something. Shirto said, you say you're not doing anything, well, what are you not doing? And Yaoshan said, not even the 10,000 sages know. I think that's such a wonderful zazen story that we can talk about that more later. Medicine Mountain and Stonehead practicing their way together. May all beings do nothing in whatever they're doing. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.